I'll give my introduction again then. My name is Bill Phillips. My folks came up here in 1937, and we were here as a family until 1956 when I turned 18, and then we left 1 year before the mine closed in 1957. And what I'm going to show this afternoon is complete history from the discovery of the ore body by Mr. Harry Holden in 1896 until the closing of 1957. This is a Larry Penberthy picture, and you can see the remnants, the finality, obviously, after Harry Holden, the mill, first start of tailings pond number one, and over here was what was to become Honeymoon Heights. Just for orientation, because I'll be talking a little bit different nomenclature, first of all, the discovery was up in this area right here. That's basically the zero point that I'm going to use to describe the levels of the mine and mill. This level is the top of what you see out here with the long rock dump, if you've been out walking around. That's called the 1500 foot level, or what we call this shortly 1500 level. That's 1500 feet below the approximate point of original discovery. And I say approximate because it may come out even in 50 foot intervals. When I get farther on, I'll be talking about tunnels. Tunnels 1, 2, 3, and 4 and 5, but primarily 1, 2, and 3. Number 3 corresponds with level 1100, which is over where the switchback is. The original miners' camp is over in this area, and we'll see photos of that. And that's what's called the 1100 foot level. In their terminology back then, that was tunnel number 3. Rather than Honeymoon Heights, which is a brand new name, which was given approximately 38 or 39 when the new miners and workers started, that area was called the Miners' Camp. And that's the original camp that was established by Harry Holden. Harry Holden, James Henry Holden, known as Harry throughout his life, in his early 20s. He was born in Springfield, Massachusetts in 1855. His grandparents, Patrick and Bridget, came from Ireland somewhere before 1830, and they settled in Upper State, New York, along the border with Quebec, right in the northeast corner of New York. Harry's father, John, was born in that area, and somehow or other, his wife and Margaret, I mean his mother and father, ended up in Massachusetts. They got married there, and then they went back to New York. When Harry was about 19, he went down to New York City in the 1880 census. I found him working in a crockery store. And according to the family legend, he was a fairly good singer, so he ended up in a singing troupe and coming across the country. And they ended up in Virginia City, Nevada. So he thought, hey, this mining deal looks a lot better than singing. So he ended up working in the minefields in Virginia City. And along the way, he also went to Denver, was an inspector for the smelter in Denver. He went to San Francisco, visited his Uncle Joseph, spent about a year with him. Joseph was a fairly prominent lawyer in San Francisco, and he decided he didn't like law either, and suggested he go to Seattle. Is there anybody here from Seattle other than myself? Any of you folks from Seattle? Okay. Mm. You probably know the Denny family. And the Denny family were the founders, among other folks, of Seattle. When Harry got there, somehow or other he was befriended, we don't know how, by the Denny family. He ended up living with Victor Denny, who was a son of David, the brother of Arthur, whom we know mostly by reputation. He ended up working for Victor at their home, doing gardening, taking care of their furnace during the wintertime, odd duties. Victor and the rest of the family invited him to come to Lake Chelan and for the purposes of prospecting the shores of the lake. And they did that for a couple of summers. And here we are in 1894, camping on the Railroad Creek Bar. This is Harry, and that's David Denny, and I believe this is his wife. And these are two Japanese maids who came with them. And they're camping in tents down here at the mouth of Railroad Creek. Let me go back. That's too soon. So anyway, they came back in 1895. They didn't find anything along the shore. And Victor and Harry came back in May of 1896. And they still didn't find anything along the shore. Victor got called back, a message came up by boat, or they went back down to Chelan and got the message, we don't know. Victor gave all his supplies, plus the rowboat that they shared in, and gave it all to Harry. He rowed back up the lake, got W.P. Robinson, a horsebacker, to take him up here. So he started prospecting up here. And as the story goes, he hiked up into Holden Lake, and one evening he was coming out. And even back then, it was very, very difficult to see the area way up on the shoulder of the mountain. Although the entire valley had been burned out, some prospector come through years earlier and burned the whole place down. And with that fire, then they could see, of course, any war outcroppings they hoped. But even with that, he couldn't see it. But as he was coming out this evening, he looked up here and he saw this coloration on the ledge up above. So the next day he came back over here on this side and hiked up the mountain and he couldn't find it, hiking around all over the place. Well, he needed to get some food, so he shot a deer. So the deer went up the mountain and he finally, after he shot it, and he finally found it in this gully wash, looked on his feet, and holy cow. So that was the start. He staked his claim. He took out ore samples, had them sent them to Seattle. He sent some on his own to Spokane to get them assayed and found out he hit a very good ore body. He got married to Alma Lord in Chelan in 1898, and then in 1899, he formed the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company and issued shares, $2.5 million. He was a pretty astute guy. He had been around. He's not your average prospector with a donkey that you see in the movies and that kind of thing. He really had kind of a really good sense of what was going on. And he knew there was no way that he was going to develop this ore body up here or even come up with a transportation system or even figure out how to process it all without getting a lot of money and somebody who really had the smarts. So he engaged two separate companies. And this was a feature in the Chelan newspaper of 1901. With that, using that as advertising, he then interested the Drummers Development Company, and I have no idea who they are. I haven't been able to find any information about this company. But they formed a subsidiary company, the Chelan Transportation and Smelting Company, and put out a couple of very fancy brochures to sell the place and get sell more stock. And what they did was trying to sell stock in this new subsidiary company and started developing some plans. And what we see here is a, it's kind of a strange processing that was going on. I don't know if they were really doing some processing in this building down here. I have not been able to find again this particular brochure. After the historian who took these photos of the brochure, his name was Nigel Adams, he, as part of his doctoral thesis for his history major at the University of Washington, did a lot of research, and most of that is what I am recording. And that's this little book. Unfortunately, there's only one more left in the bookstore. But it's my Bible, basically, and did a really excellent job. The unfortunate part, I can't not find that particular pamphlet that he has referenced. And the family whom I think had all these materials can't find it. So what they proposed was bringing the ore down the mountain on a conveyor belt to this distribution center. And you see railroad tracks making a loop down here. They were proposing a narrow gauge railway. This was an illustration of the railroad bed at 9 Mile, 2 miles down the road here. The road we come up here is this particular road. This road did get built all the way to the top of the switchbacks by this particular company. And so that road is over 100 years old that we're now traveling on today. And with a series of switchbacks, get around the this really steep area hill above the Lucerne Bar. They brought the railroad quay out over here, out to a siding, do a switch, come back, do a switch, and come back right down here. And some places you can see vestiges of that, and then a offload station here, probably a roll on into a barge. Tow the barge down to Chelan, another narrow gauge railway, down to the Columbia River, to a smelter, which they proposed on the shores of the lake. That never got done. They got the road. They tried to put in some of the road down in the around with the switchbacks today. The work crew was out of Lucerne, down at the Railroad Creek Bar. This photo was taken in 1902, and I suspect, although it's not marked, but I suspect that it is a Lindsley photo. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But here's the crew working on a rock cliff, and a view of partially completed road looking north or up the lake. This would be well up above Lucerne. You can see the shoreline down below. This was great news for the pamphlet, but this was never completed. In about 1909, drummers quit. Obviously, there was a transportation problem. They didn't have enough money to develop all this. And one of the big drawbacks, of course, is soon you have a smelter on the Columbia River. There was no railroad track at that time. So there's no way of even getting the product out down to Wenatchee and then onto the Great Northern to go into Seattle or Tacoma to the smelters. The Granby Company then came into the picture, and what they hired a fellow by the name of Lawrence Lindsley. He was a grandson of David Denny. He was a well-known Northwest scenic photographer, ranked about the same as the Curtis brothers. Anybody knows who the Edward Curtis and Asael Curtis, but it's the same time frame. In this photo, he annotated various things. The tunnel works. This would be tunnel number 3, today's 1100 level. That was the main workings for them. You can see various pathways going up to the upper levels. Right in here, you see a cook bunkhouse building. And then down in here was Harry's cabin. But as you can see, there's no 1500 level. Didn't get built until it was taken over in 1937 when they started working on that. This is in tunnel number 2. This would be the, what would be called the 800 level. And let's see, where are we? This is Mr. Holden right here. And this gentleman was the supervisor of the operation for the Granby. And what they have here is a windlass. And what they were doing is sinking a vertical shaft from tunnel number 2 down to tunnel number 3, the 1100 level, in order for them to be able to operate between the two tunnels in the wintertime. Otherwise, they have to go outside, clamber through the snowbanks to go to either one. The next one is very interesting in tunnel number 3. In that you see an air hose right here, and we see an air-operated drill. This is pretty new technology for that time. So down below, there was an air compressor. I'm not showing the other building with a steam plant, and that's how they got their air to operate their compressors. And then this is a close-up of the rock site at tunnel number 3. And let's see, I think that may be Harry's cabin right there, but I'm not sure. There's quite a bit of slope in here, but I'm not sure if that's it or not. That could be the compressor building. And here we are, is the bunkhouse cookhouse. And this is Harry Holden right here. That's his oldest son, Callie, and their dog. How many people are familiar with the hardware store in Chelan? Kelly's Ace Hardware? That's Grover Kelly. And those of you who know Pat Kelly, he's the kind of tallish, very bald fellow. That's his grandfather. Well, the Granby didn't make it either because of the transportation problem. And what's of note here is that during this period of time, not a single ounce of ore was taken out or sold anyplace. And yet, Mr. Holden was able to live very comfortably by selling the stock. You could take some personal expenses out of that according to the laws at that time. And of course, he got money from the leases from both Drummers and the Granby. And with that, he was able to live fairly comfortably. He had several properties, about a dozen properties in the town of Chelan. But when the Granby decided not to extend their lease, he had no money coming in because he wasn't selling any ore. So he took a loan out from a local banker, but the problem was it was a personal loan. It was unprotected. He died in 1918. Due to cancer, then his estate was left with this burden of the loan. In order to pay it off, Mrs. Holden had to sell the properties in Chelan, but that wasn't enough. Mr. Perry went to court and sued, and the result of that was that the mine claim had to be auctioned off. Well, there weren't any offers. There was only one, and that was Mr. Perry himself. So he kind of picked it up for a song, and it was unfortunate. And from that time on, the Holden family was never, ever involved again. And from that point, Crooker Perry was just doing assessments that was required on an annual basis. Whoops. He changed the name to Lake Chelan Copper Company. And he was looking for other people to buy the property, which took about 10 years. And it turns out that a person who was formerly working for the Granby had actually transferred to the Britannia Mining Company up in Britannia Beach, north of Vancouver, British Columbia. And he'd heard about it, it was a real good deal. So he convinced the home office, Howe Sound Company, which owned Britannia Mining Company at that time, that they were, they had the corporate offices in New York City. So they sent their engineers down, looked it over, and decided to take over the property. So Howe Sound took over the property, started development in 1929, figuring out what they were going to do. The problem was that in 1931, the prices of copper just completely fell out and dropped. They shut down all their operation, sent the people home to the Britannia, and all they had was a family caretaker. Caretakers, the Gordon family, they lived on the Cern during the winter and lived up here during the summer. This was the miners' camp as it looked in 1936, and they took out the old cookhouse, bunkhouse, put in some longhouse buildings up here. This is where the original offices were: engineering office, general office, dormitories for the men. People started building private homes in here, and you can see down below the Railroad Creek Valley. And here's another valley view that I showed last night. Now you get a really good picture of the buildings. Construction camp down below. And this is the ballpark area in here. And these white spots, see one here and here, are probably the tents. And one of those tents, about a year later, was occupied by my folks. And I found a couple of other people whose names I can't remember who claimed that he lived up there as well. And that was going on to as the town site, and then people were starting to build their homes. This is Railroad Creek, and this direction out that way would be west. This is one of the construction buildings, and here's an aerial tram, and that's how they got the initial supplies for the first development up to the miners' camp, which became Honeymoon Heights. Down below, after they widened the road, that was good. Now we had to get up to what we call Dance Camp, to the top of what's now the switchbacks. But the switchbacks weren't there. So there was an inclined tramway. It was a three-rail system. It was a counterbalance system. And in the middle, somewhere in here, it spread out to four rails so that the counterweight and the car could pass each other. This was in its final configuration. You see the rail car down here at the bottom and a bit of a dock in here. And before they put the rails in, it was a skidway. And here we see a diesel generator going up. And one of the things, I got these photos from my friend Nigel, and my friend Nigel, that we knew, that we grew up with, passed away, unfortunately, about 20 years ago. And in his collection, he had all these photos of the incline. I was trying to figure out, with this heavy equipment, how in the devil did they get it on the shore, and how did they get it on the skidway or the rail car? And finally, Mr. Howard over here would use the receipt of a photo, and it solved my problem. This photo was taken by another family, and unfortunately, didn't have enough time to scan it and put it in here because we were going through it just 2 days ago. But what they did is they had a barge that would moor right here with a crane on it. And it was apparently pulled by a tug. The tug's not in the picture, but that solved the mystery of how did they do this, because obviously men can't manhandle anything that big. And this was the compressor loaded on. These guys must be messing around, because obviously. So this gives you a really good idea right here of the rail car. Apparently they're hauling some steel on it. And this was at the top. Now you can see one of the tractors. These were treaded tractors. And one of the early trucks. And here we have the tractor again, and the same old compressor. And you see it is also a treaded wagon. Now they couldn't bring all the material stuff up. You saw the truck, it didn't come up that incoming tramway. So there was actually an early road from Lucerne, and it cut through where the switchbacks are today, almost straight up that spine. And I remember as a kid, when going up and down on the bus, and I was asking people, what the devil are those trenches? They don't look natural. And I never really got a very good answer. And I finally figured that that was a roadway that these tractors pulled the early equipment up. A truck couldn't possibly drive up that. It was basically a horse pack training trail, which the tractors hauled up. And what a road. Here's three of the early trucks. How'd you like to travel on that one? And here's the construction, just using what we call a steam shovel, but it was gas. This was actually a gasoline engine operated shovel. And one of the larger cats making probably, I don't know, could be the number one switchback. And then the completion shortly thereafter. That was in 1939, building the mill. In 1937, that's your steel structure, part of which is standing today. But that's what the full structure looked like. And these are the shops. They were all taken down. There's really nothing up there now. This building upstairs, this is the engineer's office, whole backside into here. And the engineers always had a pair of binoculars, and I didn't know that. And they used that to scan across the valley looking for deer. Well, in the wintertime, I was across the valley one day, and I was skiing out of the circle up here and went over to the falls over there. And I skied down. It was just wonderful in the spring, brand new snow, and I thought, oh man, this is going to be just outstanding. And an avalanche had come down and sealed all the crevices. And I'm going down like that. And all of a sudden, crash! Landed right on my face, spread eagle. And I just lay there. So I said, yeah, that's the end of this day. I've had it. So I went home. That night, Dad came home and says, boy, that was a great ski run you had today, wasn't it? He's been spying on me all along. Down here were various machine shops, compressor, the electrical yard where the power lines came in, and this is the west end of the mill. There's a lot of stuff parked around here, so you don't see a clear view. The portal is over this direction. Trains came through here on a circle, went to the head of the mill, and dumped their ore. This was a photo taken somewhere in the time frame of 1939 to 1941 when another fellow came up, wanted to have a job. His name was Larry Penberthy, got a job as an electrician, did a lot of photography. And I photographed just about every process up here. What we see here is where the creek was straightened. This isn't the total realignment. Over here is tailings two, what was going to be tailings two and three. And these are all pilings put in using the trees that they cut for the tailings. And you see logs placed across. If you look in very closely, and if I were to enlarge it, you would see that these are logs that they placed in to provide riffles to slow down the current. this is the clearing that was going on. And this is Mr. Penberthy here putting a choke on one of the logs to haul them out. And it's a fairly good sized slope in here. So we now have a completed mill. And we were looking up here, the office and the portal right here. On the right-hand side, this is what we call the dry. This is the change building. This is where the men came in from the mine. They were wet, because this was a wet mine. They would go in, hang their clothes on hangers, haul them up to the ceiling. The boots would go on a wire basket. And full shower facilities were available there.
Can you interject a minute? If you want to see what the wire baskets look like when you go up to the dining hall, look at the flower boxes hanging along the side of the loading dock, because in the very early 60s, the ladies doing flowers found those baskets and brought them down, and they used the village uses them for flower boxes.
And this was the early construction of the staff houses, which we know as the chalets. This is, that's probably number 9 and 8, 7 and 6. Mm. And these are the three carpenters, part of the staff, who were building the chalets. And that's number 10 and that's number 9. Here we're looking down on the Circle Road at the bottom, the schoolhouse. It's just a one-room schoolhouse for the first 2 years, and then added on to it for a second room on the end. And then back in 1949, there's another one on the other side, which you see today. There was a portable sawmill. This was one of several. There were sawmills up at the ballpark. Anybody been up there to beyond Winston? There is a ballpark for those who haven't been up there. And there was a sawmill up there. There was also another sawmill down below the mill. And I don't know if there was three separate ones or there were two and moved. But. And this is the whole completed town site that Larry Penberthy took. A composite picture, as you can see, as he climbed a tree, took a photo both ways, and combined them. And the town site, Winston. You know, I ran across something very interesting today. We keep saying that there were 101 homes. We know that total at the peak. And we know that from various lists that we've gotten from the company records. And we were trying to figure out what the split was. And in one of the Holden Miners I was looking at this morning, it says there were 23 homes were built in 1949.
In 49,
23. Yeah. But anyway, the major portion of the homes, there were three rows, as we discussed last night, were completed by 1941. And then in 1949, with an influx of more families, needed more workers, additional homes were added. I'll just put it down. Here you see two families' homes under construction. This one has an interesting history. This was owned by the Rogers family. And it took them a while to build that. In fact, there was indication they came up in 1937, but I'm not sure where they lived. What I found in the census that Mr. Rogers was in the dormitory in the 1940 census, and his family was living in Chelan. But this is his house under construction. How many children did they have?
12.
It was 12.
But all of them didn't live up here because some were already adults by the time they moved up here. And Dorothy, one of the daughters who married a guy and has done an interview, she talked about they did live in a tent at the ballpark during a period of time when he was building the house, because she talks about the mother, about them gathered around the little wood stove and Anna reading stories to them when they were little. So the kids lived here a short time, but they spent a good share of the time in that, the kids as going to school in that Chelan house.
Yeah. I suspect what may have happened is what happened to my folks is that when the snow started flying, those tents were not suitable for wintering over. And my folks actually built a shell around their tent. But because it was remote up there and they didn't want to do snow removal up that far, this is my understanding from my folks, they had to move out. And they moved down to Lucerne, excuse me. And I suspect for the Rogers family, the same thing may have happened. They may have lived in the tent in the summertime while Mr. Rogers was building his home. And then in the wintertime, maybe the family then was wintering in Chelan, like I found in the 1940 census.
Do you know how many bedrooms the house had?
No, I don't. Did you ever hear?
No, I don't. But I do know that by the 50s, with most of the kids gone, they had turned the top floor into an apartment that they rented out. But I don't know how many total they had. And I'm not sure how many of the kids actually lived up here.
Yeah.
We were trying to figure out, because some of them were already adults and gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do know that Gail was the youngest. She lived up here. And obviously the twins, because they were young. Dixie lived up here.
Dorothy
was in some of the both graduated from 8th grade. So that's what, 6 that we know for sure that lived up here.
And there's a dean that is in the scout photo with Elizabeth Taylor.
That's true.
And then they had a son, Jockey, who drowned at Chelan on a school, down at Lucerne on a school picnic. And I believe he was 8 or 9, and that's the early 40s. So there were quite a few of them that did live up here.
He kept adding on rooms, and it's kind of a joke.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell the story here, and I think it's probably a good one.
Not as good as John Bly, but tell the story.
It's not going to be as good as John Bly. I was going to read it out of here, but I'm going to have to tell it. Well, he wanted to enlarge the house a little bit more, and he needed to have a basement.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this large rock in the basement. And he's an underground miner, and he knows how to do mining. So he thought this over, and there's no way he's going to get this rock out by pounding on it. So he thought about it a while, apparently, and, well, one stick may do it. But you know, two sticks may be better. So he did that. Blew all the windows out of the house. His wife's pieces all fell off the shelves. I think she was in the middle of doing
finished pickles.
Well, the story was he appeared before John Bly and Jack Curzon, the manager. John Bly was mine superintendent at the time. I believe we're mine foreman, either one. And they figured there's nothing that we could do that would be any worse than the wrath of Anna, his wife. So they sent him home.
When Gail told the story at the reunion, she said that the vacuum cleaner actually ended up in the ceiling of the bedroom. And I believe John said that he was actually walking toward Winston when he heard the noise and saw smoke, so he actually went up and saw it and saw Anna's face. Mm-hmm. And thought about all those kids. He couldn't fire it, but
was the water system developed before the homes were installed or built?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, they were. The reason it's called Winston, I should have talked about that a little bit. Winston did not build any of the homes, but Winston Brothers, who had constructed the road and provided the supplies for the townsite here, actually platted the entire Winston area. And Winston Brothers put in the electrical systems, which is all over here. They put in the water system and the sewage system. So everything is ready to go for the owner to go in and build their homes. I was going to try to find animals. Yeah, forget it. It's too much. So anyway. Poor Mr. Rogers. And this was one of the houses, those you did not see my presentation last night, if you walk up to Winston, walk up that first road all the way up to the top. long ways up in the snow to carry groceries and that kind of thing. This was the completed dock at the time, and at the end of the dock was this stiff-legged derrick. And that was used to pick up the ore buckets and take them off the ore truck, put them on the barge. And that was the first incarnation. A colleague of my father, a fellow by the name of Vint Clark, who graduated with my father from engineering school at the University of Washington, did a time and motion study. He says, this is ridiculous. This is not the way to go with this kind of derrick. It has limited swing room and so forth. He says, we ought to have the same thing as down at the Chelan dock, and that's a traveling crane. So that's what they did. They ended up putting rails down and putting in a much larger crane and gave them a lot more swing room. So, and this is at the Chelan dock, April 18, 1938. Finally, the first delivery of the ore, 42 years after the discovery by Mr. Holden. It took 42 years to be able to come up with a transportation system. And what was very interesting, I thought, in looking at the company records, was that even Howe Sound was thinking of going with a narrow gauge railway up and down the valley, all the way up to, let's see, March of 1937. And they had correspondence with a number of people who were making proposals. I can sell you this car, I can sell you this locomotive, blah, blah, blah. Because people were trying to sell stuff back in the economic times occurring at then. And then in April, they sent a reply off to another fellow who was trying to offer more equipment and says, no, we changed our mind. We're going to go with trucks. And what they had done is a trade-off, and all of a sudden, they figured out that modern trucks were available at that time, and that was one of the big holdups. So here we are, looking overhead, the town site and Holden, Winston's site, I should say, taken from the Copper Peak, and it's all completed town. And here's our lower road and the middle road. Look at these wonderful houses.
Can you back up one?
Sure.
Show that Roger one now with the three stories.
Ah, there we go. Good.
It's three there stories at that point, but the town was finished.
How much was added on?
And by the way, that beautiful tree in the middle is standing in our front yard.
That's your guy. Yours,
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's the garage that went with our house. And that the one tree, that tree right there. We were there today. The tree is still there. That's how we find our place.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, the tree is still there. The top is bent and it's starting to die, but and the trunk is bent. But that's how we find our house.
Bill, do you want to explain what the people paid for rent? How they paid? You didn't mention that this was Forest Service land.
I don't know how much they paid, but they did have to pay for a permit to the Forest Service, and I don't remember what the number is.
And then they paid for the power. And then they paid a couple of pennies per power.
And it also looked like, we were looking at some records the other day, and it also looked like they were personal property taxes, and I could not determine, this was from Chelan County, and I could not determine whether it was a personal property tax or a
real estate
tax. But it may be, as being a personal property tax, it may be that the value of the house was included in that. And I think, what did we see, Larry? Do you remember the number that we were looking at? $17?
Yeah.
This one house for
less than 20.
A one-year assessment. Mm-hmm. We could not find the Forest Service fee. I think there's some records someplace that we have, but we didn't find that.
Who was responsible for building the stone walls?
The individual owners built their own stone walls. And some of them were rather elaborate. It took them quite a while to build. But they could pretty much, I don't know what the restrictions were on doing that kind of thing, if there were. There were probably certain guidelines. There were certainly guidelines on building the homes. Guidelines on paint. Actually, I don't know if anybody used paint other than on the window frames, but the outsides were basically stained, not painted. And most of them had cedar shingles, on the sides. They were very well-built homes. They had to be built to Forest Service restrictions and regulations. They had to fit into the environment, and that's why they used basically dual paints, gold, red, green, and brown were the colors. That, I don't remember anything beside that.
That's all I remember.
Been up in the upper row, and we did have TV. Later on, it was in the 1950s, a couple of the engineers figured out, hey, we're facing Spokane, and sure enough, with putting a repeater up, they can direct another signal into the town, and we had very, very snowy TV. And then there was the snow, this was in 1956.
Yeah.
Look at that. That very top house I showed you a couple of frames ago, this is Irene Kahn walking up to that house. And look how you had to get up to that house way up there on the top. But it was great for playing in the snow, lots of skiing, lots of sledding. It would always surprise me on this photo that we see private cars. And I was going to go back to what Linda was talking about on her home and her father's garage. And her father parked a pickup.
Yeah, he had a pickup.
In that garage. And in the wintertime, he had to keep it in there. And only a few people, particularly, there were certain superintendents and so forth, the managers. And I think Shirley Clark was one also, who was the head of transportation, who were allowed to have cars because they needed to get to places if there was an emergency. But other than that, cars really kept in the garage, not in the roads. I can't explain this. Down at Lucerne, there was an area there very close to the Howe Sound dock where people took their cars, took the batteries out, left them for the winter. I'll show some photos later on how the cars got up and down the lake. But we sent our car down to the dock. They had a pallet, drove the car on the pallet. There was a special bridle for the crane, lifted it up and plopped it right down on top of the ore buckets. And then took it down the Schlein.
The garage with our house, the reason we had a garage is the fellow who had built the house and owned it before we had it, or at least one of the previous owners, had been on the transportation crew and had a Jeep that he kept during the wintertime. And he got out, and that garage was built in place, so it stayed with the house, and we got it. They had another metal garage that at one time was at one end of the middle row, and later it ended up at the other end of the middle row that they could move. It was a movable metal garage. And whoever had it at that end moved, and the new transportation guy was, they moved it. But ours was permanent. That's why we lucked out to have the pickup.
One of the other things also was very critical was the snow load. Here's our postmaster, Al Hoshauser, shoveling off his roof. But this is something that everybody had to watch very, very carefully to make sure they kept it pretty well shoveled off. I'm surprised he even had this much snow on here. But that was an ongoing process. Down here on the company buildings, it was not a problem because of the metal roofs. But all of the chalets, for example, had shingle roofs. And I remember the workers coming down and then shoveling the roofs off. The unfortunate part was, when we were living in number 7, for example, on the uphill side, the snow would slide off, hit the ground, and then stop in one solid mass, and lots of ice. And our folks said, you're not to go under there. Well, it was a great pump, let me tell you. But it was such a snow load that it caused the house to do this. And then we wouldn't be able to close the front door. So we had to call in Charlie Dolphy, the carpenter, to go try to fix things. And there was no way you could fix the whole house. It was an ongoing problem. So during the winter, so even if the snow didn't come off the roof, the slopes are steep enough, that the snow load on the uphill side would push against the side of the house and distort the whole framework. Another thing is people were able to order groceries. We did have a store in the later years in the bottom of number six. But people could order a lot of provisions from this store down in Chelan. They put the order together, put it in boxes, write the family's name on it. The company would bring it up at their expense. They didn't charge anybody for it. The freight truck would pick up those boxes of groceries down at the dock and bring them up and deliver them to the family's homes right to their doorstep. And it was really, really a great service.
Oh, you can see the chains on the truck.
Oh, yes. Everything had to be well chained up. The other feature of Mr. Rogers was his pickup truck. This was, that was his trademark.
Six kids in that picture.
What's that?
Six kids in that picture.
They're not all his, though.
Well, there's,
I think there's seven. There's one holding a dolly right behind his head.
Is that a dolly?
Yeah, there's a dolly there.
I think it's a doll.
These are the twins, Robert and Raymond. Is that Dixie? This is Bill Small. That's his sister, and I don't remember who was delivering the newspapers. And that's the other thing, too, is that we did have two newspapers delivered up here year-round, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and the Spokane Spokesman Review in both areas of the town. And you can see the rock wall there is very extensive. This was my first grade school teacher. She was up here, or this family was up here for 3 or 4 years. Mr. Bowie built this house in 1936, as you can see. And it's one of the long-standing ones. And we showed this last night with a beautiful veranda. This was the corner house on the middle road. This is rather unique. This is Helen Small standing on the back side of the house. She's on this little ledge going to put out laundry. And they had a clothesline that she's hanging on to right here. And you can't see the line. It came up this way to a house on the roll up above. And went to another house. So they had to coordinate their laundry going back and forth on the clothesline. And we didn't have enough power for dryers. A lot of people did have power washers, or at least a power washer with a hand wringer. But we all had to hang up our clothes outside, let them freeze. That kind of dehydrates them, if you will. Bring them back in, warm them up, take a little bit of the moisture on.
Bill, is that the Rogers house being added onto in the background? The
yes.
Guy up on the scaffold?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is.
Looks like it might
be. Yeah. Yeah, good eye. And sometimes we were able to grow gardens. The soil up here isn't the greatest, but a number of people did try to grow flower and vegetable gardens, and this was with, in the area between the small house, small family house, I should say, in the Rogers. And some people built outdoor barbecues out of stone with a grill on it. This was the Sims house, and he was a very good fisherman, and he grilled his fish right directly on that plate. This is Mrs. Sims in their kitchen. It's a typical 1940s, early 50s type, very tight, not much room. This is what we're going to model our display after in the new museum. Isn't that right, Larry?
Right.
This is the living room, dining room at Christmas time. And this is a different house. Excuse me?
Did you have problems with bear and cougars?
No problem with cougars. I don't remember any cougars in town. I heard of basically one that was earlier probably than the one you think of. What was your story? No?
One winter, on a clear, snowy, full moonlit night, there's a little hill behind Pop Row with a cap at the far end. that we called Little Knoll, and some girlfriend, some other kids and I, we climbed up and rolled down. And my dad's partner, Casey Spurgeon, lived in the house on that row. And when I came home and told Mom what I'd been doing, we got in trouble because he had been hearing a cougar scream up there the last few nights. So that is as close as I'm aware, but we weren't allowed to go up Little Knoll anymore.
Well, when Bear, there was one summer that I remember that there were a couple of bears running around down here. In fact, my brother was chased by one up in behind 1 and 2 on that fire break back then. And I think that bear had to be shot because they couldn't get rid of it. What was happening, I think, is that year was very, very dry. There wasn't much food for the bears. And a lot of the ladies were canning. We got the smell up on number 9. I think it was that one of the bears tried to break in through the back porch, which was screened in, ripped the screen off. She yelled and the bear ran away. Other than that, I don't know of any problems with that. It's just that one summer.
It's close to 5, I'm not sure where you're going. So.
Yeah, we'll probably have to. Oh, I can go for 5:30 if people want to stick around.
Yeah.
I have the time allotted.
Okay.
If people want to go out to dinner earlier, whatever, you're free to do so. So this is one of the TV sets, just to prove that we did have it. We had to pluck up wood for the winter. This is the Phillips Oldsmobile.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why my dad brought it up here. It was a one really luxury vehicle. By the time we got done, it was a wreck.
Is it your Pontiac?
It's Pontiac,
isn't it? And this is what the fountain lunch looked like at the time. And you notice that the swivel chairs around this end, which aren't there now.
They've got three left.
And they were, see, I guess they're down this end, aren't they? Those are still there.
Yeah, it's that one big.
What's that one today?
Okay. And then this end was a store area. We didn't have those booths back then. And as we saw last night in the census, there were people who had jobs assigned specifically to the fountain lunch. At first they were men, and then later on, the women took over and ran it.
Showed the grill.
I have the grill? Mm-hmm. No, I don't have the grill. We got a barber. And that's what the gym looked like. Played basketball on it. As you see here, we had a portable backstop. It would fold up, go off to the side. Could have dances in here, brought in bands from Wenatchee and Chelan for the New Year's Eve balls. And, this one was a costume ball. We had a band, viewed movies. We had movies 3 times a week, Sunday night, Wednesday night, and Friday night. We had union meetings. Were conducted in the rec hall also. And I'm still trying to get old, my brother to convince me that I think this is our father sitting right here. He was a mining engineer, but he still had, in the very early years when Penberthy took this photo, he was working underground. In the pool hall with the poker tables in the back. When, let's see, I guess they had the slot machines at this time. I don't see any of them in this photo. And this is a Penberthy photo.
So it must have come a little later. They were here till 52.
Yeah, because I think they were along this wall, as I remember.
Right.
The jukebox. Poker table. Penberthy used to love this photo that he took. Because if you look very closely, you can see 5 aces.
Timothy loved to stage his photos.
He did. And the hospital, Dr. Lom examining Mr. Penberthy, another setup. And our Doc Dürer was a traveling dentist, although he listed his permanent address in 1940 as up here. But he did come up on a regular basis. I don't remember what his regularity was.
I don't know if he came twice a year, or I think maybe twice a year, and he'd come for about a week at a time.
Yeah, but his main office was in Chelan. He was one of the roughest dentists ever. He was. But he was pretty good.
We were family friends, and he pulled two teeth of mine, and I told him the Novocaine hadn't numbed my mouth, and he said I was a naughty girl and pulled the teeth anyway, and my family friendship ended.
Ooh.
Yeah, my dad was furious.
Oh, really? Well, he pulled my wisdom teeth.
Mm-hmm. He pulled two small front teeth for me.
Yeah, let's see, we'll move on. We've been inside the dormitories. The other one, summer activities, was softball. And we had teams, a lot of competition. We had an engineers team, miners team, storage team, surface team, transportation team, depending upon which year you're talking about and so on. And that was a time, of course, when the engineers and Jack Curzon, who was a mine manager on one team, and that was the one time everybody could haze the management. We had 4th of July picnics, and holy cow, who's that?
Bill showed me that. I recognized it only because I remember the jerry jacket that I'm wearing there.
But the company picked up the expense, all the expense for the 4th of July picnics. We had games and competitions for adults and for all the kids. And Labor Day, we had a picnic, and the union then picked up all the expenses for the Labor Day picnic. And fighting contests. Oh my gosh, there she is again. How'd you do it? And bowling was very, very popular. Here were the signs which for the various bowling teams listed the rank order for the teams for the year as competition went on. We always had a Christmas Carol program. It was conducted in the village center or the rec hall. All grades participated. The carpenters would come down, build a stage for the festivities, and afterward there were presents for every child in the community.
Wow.
And everybody came down and a shot of the schoolhouse, which was a one-room schoolhouse the first 2 years. And we're graduating. We had only grades 1 through 8. Later on there was a kindergarten, which was in the basement of the schoolhouse, and a lot of people moved out. Those of us who stayed, there were various options for high school. There were various boys and prep schools in Seattle, Tacoma, and Spokane, and Walla Walla, places I know that people went. Other people stayed with friends and relatives in Chelan and Wenatchee. There were a couple of girls who wrote up memories about that we have in our records who actually worked their keep for families in Wenatchee or Chelan, mm-hmm. by which they did household chores and babysat their children when they needed to, and they got their room and board and lived with them while they're going to a high school in Wenatchee and Chelan. And one of the women now wrote that it was really a great opportunity for her, because on occasion the family would go off to Seattle and stay in a nice hotel because they wanted to go shopping. And her job then was to take care of the children in the hotel while the folks went out on the town. And in addition to the school programs at Christmas, we also always had a spring program, sometimes just a sing program. We had operettas and plays, depending upon what our teacher, Florence Steele, decided to do. One of the biggest ones was The Frog and the Prince. Big, long opera. That's my brother. He was The Frog and the Prince.
The butler was the doctor's son.
Let's see, where, oh, there he is right
there. That's
Danny Mickens. That's Danny Mickens and...
Janet's the queen, Janet Adams.
Yeah.
Darling Mother. Princess.
But it's pretty elaborate sets. The kids, we would, with the parents' help, would make up the background set. And generally we try to get everybody to participate in the whole school in the opera, so we see all the younger kids.
Take it back one, I think we have that tablecloth.
We do?
Doesn't that look familiar?
Well, it could be. You may be right.
Is it on the table?
It could be.
Very much so. Not one just like it.
And isn't Janice's dress up in the museum where it used to be?
The dress that was in the museum was my dress from Robin Hood.
Oh, okay.
Here's our Campfire Girls.
But here's our Campfire Girl group. And we were very active youth groops up here. Okay. Bluebirds, Campfire Girls, Cub Scouts, and Boy Scouts, and all the groups were very, very active. Mm-hmm. Campfire Girls went out for their enclaves.
Grand Council Fire, it was called the Menachie.
And the Boy Scouts.
Show the leader there.
Oh, you want me to show the leader?
The leader there. It's Bill's mother.
Oh.
That's my mother.
Mm.
She had no girls.
She had a whole lot of them there.
The Boy Scouts were very, very active. This is very early on. You see Glacier Peak in the background, and the troop at this time was, I think this was probably 1942. How old do you think Bernie is? This is, I think Bernie was on, Trainer was on the trip. He was probably about 12, 13, 14.
Probably like that, so.
So this is on Cloudy Pass, looking west from Cloudy Pass. This is on, well, close to the divide of the Cascade Mountains, and they were headed for the peak, the Glacier Peak. One of the things we also learned was to do first aid in the snow. That was always fun, and camping in the snow, which was not so good. So here I am bending over, putting a leg splint on, using a ski pole. And this is our group. I don't see Nigel not in here. Anyway, that's me right here. And this is our scoutmaster. And we were headed out to Camp Reed. And this is the thing we always did every year is we joined with the rest of the Boy Scout district down in Chelan for Camp Reed. We also every year went to summer camp up out of Wenatchee. So we did all the kinds of things that you would expect in all the towns and cities outside of here. There's really not much different. One of the things that was really nice while we were growing up is there was a young couple come in. He was an accountant. They had grown up in Seattle. And they were very strong outdoors people. And they really liked to take the teenagers out with us. And we went to the various lakes around, it was boys and girls, to learn camping. And on this particular one, here we are on top of Martin Ridge. And here we are climbing Copper Peak. This is the doctor's son, this is me, and this is my classmate from eighth grade. And here we are on the top of the peak of Copper Peak, looking down. The unfortunate part on this one, I hadn't been eating and drinking enough. And I looked over the edge, and all of a sudden, I went down. So we had to spend about a half hour or an hour while I tried to recover before I go back down. But those were really, really unique trips. This was Marion Sullivan. She and her husband who did all this for us. And early skiing, they had a rope tow way up at the other end of Winston Camp, but it only lasted 1 year. Nobody kept it up. And these folks, when they came in, hey, we've got to have a ski tow, because we were always walking and everything. So they got the community involved. In fact, we found some paperwork the other day where everybody, a number of people were contributing $5 to be able to buy this. What it was a four-man toboggan, with a one-horse engine on it. And that made skiing a lot more enjoyable. This is my dad riding. Bus transportation was always a hassle. They had to put chains on. But all our buses are rigged up, so they put the luggage on the top. This was before they had the covered walkway down here, obviously. Snow removal with snow goes, snow blowers. I was reading just an article the other day in our Holden Miner, and at that particular time, I can't remember what year it was, they had an immense number of slides on the road. It was closed for 2 days while they tried to clear it. And they said there was 20 feet of snow on the road that they had to clear out, and they had to make a temporary road to get over that. And it was only by that way they were able to say we're closed only 2 days, but that was just to bring supplies up and down. But they couldn't get the ore trucks through, obviously, that way. And we had eventually two Caterpillars to move snow around. And they go in around all these buildings, come down the circle, put a great big hump between the recreation hall and the school, made great sledding. Go to the other end of Winston, do the same thing in the middle road down there for the sledding. Put a great big ramp down the bottom because that's where the snow had to go, and it's great for kids, of course. Transportation here is on, this is typical, this was the old speedway. And this was the earlier boats. This is the speedway here, Cascade Flyer. This one of them, I don't remember the other one. Landing at the Lucerne Dock. Here we are at the company dock with one of the trucks, either loading it up or unloading at this point, putting the buckets off and on the barges.
Yeah.
And you see the cars sitting on these pallets, and that's how we got the cars up and down. Bring cars up in the spring, take them down in the fall. Here cars are going down in the wintertime, and this white box here is a refrigeration unit, and that's how we got our perishable goods up here. And there's a little box right up here. There was the compressor and the engine still on it. This shows a bit of it. Here's a good close-up of that refrigeration box sitting right on top of those ore buckets. The barges were carrying at least 40 of these ore buckets. Each bucket carried 5 tons. One bucket empty was 1 ton.
Mm-hmm.
How are we doing here? And you can see them starting the unloading. I don't know what this is. In fact, I don't know what this load is.
Looks like machinery and logs almost.
It does look like logs. But here you get a good shot of the tug. It's called the E.B. Schley. He was the first president of the Howe Sound Company, and that was the family, the Schley family, which started Howe Sound Company back in New York. And the last day of school, 1957. And the mill is quiet, ending 20 years of production. The Bray house with the windows removed because someone decided they want to use the windows. Now, took these 2 years after? I don't remember.
What neighbor?
It says after 1 year.
No, when Tootie came up to take the pictures when she visited, it was 1 year or 2 years after closure.
I thought it was 1 year, I think. 1 year after closing. Are these Tootie's pictures?
These are Tootie's pictures.
Yeah,
this is hers.
I think they came up and... No, she said.
Yeah, it is. I have it right here. I have to just look at my own stuff. That was her house. This is 1 year after closure. And you see what happens with the snow loads. And these were the homes with the metal roofs. Had more of a problem than the...
They were also the ones that were built later, weren't
yeah.
they? In the new addition?
Yes, I believe these are. And they were apparently weren't built as well as the original homes. And there's our Boy Scout cabin all by itself, and that's it. Thank you.
The Girl Scout cabin is still here. It's the Forest Service cabin.
Mm. Wow.
those are fabulous shots.